Hello and welcome to a new edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior. This is the international service of the Argentine Radio, transmitting from the city of Buenos Aires via the shortwaves of WRMI, Miami Radio International, and also via internet on RAE.com.ar. My name is Fernando Farias, and I am bringing you this show in English for Monday, September 15, 2025. We're going to have on today's program an interview that I recorded several years ago with Robert Cox, the former editor of the Buenos Aires Herald, who talks to us about the years in which he headed the Herald during the military dictatorship, considering that the BA Herald was the first media outlet in Argentina, within Argentina, to report on human rights violations and especially disappearances. We'll also have a feature on the African roots of tango, something that many in the English-speaking world are not entirely aware of, that tango comes mainly from African percussion-driven music that was played and danced to by the African population of the African Afro-Argentine population, or Afro-Rioplatense, because it is also something from Uruguay, candombe mainly. But that will come after enjoying a little bit of music, and right after this first song we'll play, we'll have that interview with Robert Cox, and then the feature on the African roots of tango. This show airs on the shortwaves of WRMI. The frequency is 5,850 kilohertz. We are also streaming through our webpage, rae.com.ar, and via our app for mobile devices, Digital Rae, that you can download for free. Let's get started with music. Ah, I almost forgot. You can send emails to qslrae@gmail.com or letters to my Poo Street 555, and that's a good way of sending a reception report if you have one. Now, let's get started with a track from what many consider to be the best rock album ever from Argentina, which is Arto by Luis Alberto Spinetta. The album is labeled as Pescado Rabioso, Spinetta's former band. Is labeled as a record by Pescado Rabioso, but is in reality is a solo album by Luis Alberto Spinetta, who had left his band Pescado not long before. This is an album from 1973, and this is the album opener. Todas las hojas son del viento. All leaves belong to the wind.
Dale tibia leche de tu cuerpo. Todas las hojas son del viento, ya que las mueve hasta en la muerte. Todas las hojas son del viento, menos la luz del sol. La luz del sol. Hoy que un hijo hiciste, cambia ya tu mente. Cuídalo de drogas, nunca lo reprimas. Dale el aura misma de tu sexo. Todas las hojas son del viento, ya que las mueve hasta en la muerte. Todas las hojas son del viento, menos la luz del sol. Menos la luz del sol. Thank you.
It is an honor to introduce Robert Cox, the former editor of English language newspaper, the Buenos Aires Herald. Thank you for being with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I used to listen to Ray, and I have over the years, so it's lovely to be in front of this microphone, speaking out to everybody all over the world who listens in.
Well, that's great. The pleasure and the honor is ours. Well, to start with, can you tell us a bit about your youth in England and how you came to settle in Argentina?
Well, my newspaper days began delivering newspapers when my father died, and my mother moved to the coast in Essex, Frinton-on-Sea, and I started delivering newspapers. And then I went to the local paper and said, I'd like to work for nothing, I'd like to work for free. In those days, it was an unusual thing to do, and so they were astonished. This was in my school vacations. I was in what they call the sixth form there, and I would have gone to university, but I liked it so much, and they offered me a job. And so I stayed into journalism all that time.
Sorry, what year was that?
That would have been 1950, something like that. I'm bad on dates. Before I went into the Navy, I was in the Navy for 2 years in the Korean War. But let me go back to my father, because it's key. My father used to come to Argentina, used to come to Buenos Aires. He was a Marconi man, one of the early operators on the liners that used to come to Buenos Aires. He would go to Valparaiso. He was on the P&O line and then the Royal Mail line. Always as a radio operator. In those days, of course, it was, you know, which he showed me how to do, and I never managed to get it going. And he loved Buenos Aires. He must have come to Buenos Aires in the 20s, before the crash, and he thought it was such a magnificent city that he tried to persuade my mother to emigrate from Britain, immigrate into Argentina. She, being very English, wasn't willing to take off to the other side of the world, and so that never happened. But it left me with always an enormous interest in Argentina. And so many years later, when I just finished 2 years national service in the Navy, I'd been to Korea and come back, and I was working then. I went working on a newspaper in the north of England in a place called Hull, and there was a wonderful newspaper at that time called the World's Press News, which offered newspaper jobs all over the world, mostly English language, because at that time the British Empire left behind the English language and these newspapers, which served an international community. And I saw this advertisement of the Buenos Aires Herald. I thought, that's marvelous. And I got the job. I think everybody else dropped out, probably the same reason my mother, that they thought it was too far to go and too exotic. And so I came here on a Royal Mail ship, second class, with my tennis racket and a dinner jacket and just a few books, important books, and all in a big trunk. And we took us over a month to get here, which was marvelous. We stopped everywhere you can think of, Recife, Brazil. We went through Madeira, everywhere you could go, and arrived here at a time when Argentina was struggling to get back to democracy with Frondizi. And
1959.
Yeah, I arrived exactly I arrived on April the 4th, 1959. And it's what they call an interesting life, you know.
Well, yes, in a way, your father was the responsible of your finally settling in Argentina.
Yeah, he left me with this idea of Argentina that I wanted to see, and I really didn't intend to stay here. At that time, you had a contract of 4 years, and then you, believe it or not, you had 4 years vacation back in Britain with the passage paid here and there. It sounds impossible.
Same as today.
It's unbelievable. And I thought, you know, I'd like to come to Argentina, and then I'd like to move. I'd like to go around the world. And I didn't have any money, so that was one of the attractions of going to Buenos Aires, that they would pay my passage. But, of course, I met my wife here, and I fell in love with Argentina. It's there are times when I've not been too happy about things here, as you know. But, you know, you're journalists too, and you know that we as journalists, we tend to face kinds of problems that other people don't. It's a dangerous profession in many ways. As we know today, there are journalists being killed all over the world, and we're being killed because we're trying to tell people what's happening and what the truth is. And when I first came to Argentina, the Herald was a very... One friend said to me, is it still as quaint as it was? And, you know, quaint in the terms of sort of... And it was strange because we used to cover Buckingham Palace and the royal family in great length, you know, and all those things and community things and things like that. And, of course, the events in Argentina made it such that one wanted to understand the country and wanted to get out. And the other funny thing is, and it is funny, I mean, it's kind of funny in a way, they believed at that time that they couldn't get Argentine young people to work on the paper. They were elderly people, and they were hoping to keep the newspaper going as long as they were going, so they were bringing in young people. And British journalists were cheaper than Americans, so that's, you know. And they had the idea that Argentine young people would be out dancing all the time. And at that time, we used to finish the paper at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we really did. They were incredible hours, but it was like being in something that... my life was almost in the newspaper. And, of course, the things that were happening in Argentina meant that as a journalist, you went out to find out about them. And so that's really what happened that changed the Herald from being a very good international newspaper always, played a wonderful role during the war, which helped it enormously because the rival paper, The Standard, which was owned by Irish Argentines, and it took the side of the Axis, while the Herald was very staunchly pro-Allied, so much so that the editor was arrested in Congress for a while for violating Argentine neutrality at that time. But of course, it helped the newspaper to gather, you know, its reputation. And during, the dictatorship of Perón, which was a dictatorship, I wasn't here then, but one knows enough to know that life was very controlled in those days. The press was very controlled. It was it was an elected dictatorship, but it was. And the Herald played an important role at that time, too. And it was then that people started to say that the Herald said in English what the Spanish-language newspapers covered up in Spanish. A little bit of an exaggeration, but you know, some truth in it. The great thing about the Herald was that it was small, it had an international readership, and it was possible for it to be completely independent. And I think that's why it was always very democratic, too. And unlike The Standard, which was the old established newspaper, which, if it still existed today, would be the oldest newspaper in Argentina. Sounds incredible, an English-language newspaper, but that was because the port, you know. Buenos Aires is such an important port that English was the language of the sea, of the shipping lines. And so the first newspapers, not the very first, but the one that established, was The Standard. And the Herald really took over from them. And, I'm very proud of the newspaper itself, enormously proud of it. It's well over 100 years. I should have looked it up to see exactly how many it was. But
Well, regarding the papers, coverage of the junta, it's also that really contributed to the Herald reputation, in particular your reputation as a journalist. Covering those early days of the Proceso Argentina, when did you realize that the junta was doing something illegal in counteracting terrorism?
Well, I also worked as a correspondent for a number of other publications. Journalists are not very well paid anywhere in the world unless they become stars, and that was certainly true there. And I had a large family; I had 5 children. But anyway, I was a journalist, and so I would go out and report for other people. And that probably was one of the reasons why I knew earlier than anybody else that things were not the way they were supposed to be. I mean, the military was saying that they were going to restore democracy. It became pretty clear afterwards that when nothing that we would complaining about before, which were the Ford Falcons without number plates, the kidnappings, the assassinations that were taking place before the coup, none of them stopped after the coup. In fact, it got worse. And a number of things happened. Perhaps one of the other key things was that we had a phone call one day. We published a death notice. It's a report of a family who died. And Andrew Graham Yule knew his father knew the family that called up and said, "Look, there were a few errors in the death notice." And we realized something funny had happened. So we went out together to see the family, the old people whose daughter, her husband, had been taken away at 3 o'clock in the morning and found later on more dead than alive. He'd been so badly tortured and thrown into a ditch. And some nuns tried to save his life, but they weren't able to do that. And the reason that he was, of course, that was something that was enormously shocking and very early on, because what we discovered is that he had been picked up. He ran the laboratory of Squibb, the Squibb chemical company in Zarate. Now, terrible things happened in Zarate, which still haunt me when I know about them, when I hear about them again. And because he was about 30 and he needed to get his chemical engineering degree, he'd worked in the laboratory, he was running the laboratory, but if he didn't get his degree, probably he would no longer be running. And so he went back to university, and because of that, he'd invite other students back to study at home with him, and he became a student again. That made him immediately suspicious, and so we discovered what had happened, and we went and talked to the family. What had happened was they came, knock on the door, they looked through the stained glass window on the door in an old house and saw this silhouette, looked like a policeman. They weren't particularly surprised then, because things happened in the laboratory and telephones were not very good in those days, so they opened the door. And these particular people behaved reasonably decently, and they stole a few things, but they were guns, antique guns, but nothing else. And they just said they needed to take him away for some questioning. Of course, when his body turned up, there was a huge funeral. He was very well known in Zarate. And while the funeral was taking place, some of these Ford Falcons went round and threw out leaflets, trying to give the impression that he was a leader of the Montaneros who had betrayed him. These things happened all the time. There was always this black propaganda trying to change what had happened. Unfortunate, we just couldn't. We talked very closely to the family. There was no way that we could report that story because they were just terrified. They knew, they thought that if word got out about what had happened, they would become and be killed. Three beautiful young girls and the mother and the old grandparents. So that was the first shocking thing, that we knew in absolute, complete detail what had happened and were horrified that we really couldn't do anything about it. What I did do was, I was trying to raise the alarm, because the abroad, the coup was seen as a velvet, a velvet revolution, bloodless, and to some extent it seemed like that to begin with. The sun shone, and I think we all thought that law's going to come back, democracy's going to come back, and it wasn't happening. And so we would do things in the Herald, but that didn't have a very loud voice. I was at that time a correspondent, stringer, as they call them, which meant that I was a correspondent in Argentina of the Washington Post. So I wrote two stories with my byline on them, because I wanted to do that. First of all, I didn't want it to be anonymous. Looking back, it was probably crazy, but it might not have worked. And one was to say this is not a velvet revolution. The disappearances are still continuing. And changing it a bit to give an idea of what happened so that it wouldn't be recognized by the military, I described this case that had happened and other cases that by then I knew about, to say these things are happening here. And the other thing that I did was said that, unfortunately, it's absolutely not true to say that in Argentina there's freedom of the press. There is not. There is an agreement of self-censorship between the main newspapers and the military government. There's a gentleman's agreement going on. And so I explained what the situation of the press was. I had a good friend in the government at that time, Walter Klein, who was the second in charge in the economy ministry under Martínez de Hoz. And he came to me and said, "You're crazy. Why did you put your name on this?" I said, "I want so that people know exactly what I'm doing and why I'm doing it." The reason that I couldn't write those stories in the Herald was, one, that it could have resulted in the family I mentioned being killed to close shut up everything. And the other was that I wanted to be able to continue to report. And we managed to do that. We managed to save lives. What we discovered was is that if we could get a story out quickly enough, and if there was particularly if there was some foreign connection, because the newspaper was read by diplomats, and so then they would ask questions. If we could say, this person had a scholarship in Spain or in the United States or somewhere like that. So, quite honestly, the readers used to complain and say that, some of them used foul language, terrible letters to me. Newspapers full of human rights. It wasn't full of human rights, except that we were concerned about human beings' lives, and we discovered that we could actually save lives. Now, it meant that you had to investigate very carefully the case so that it wasn't the military would always try to trick you up and say that what we were saying was false. And you had to work out with the family whether they agreed with you that it was worth doing. In the cases that I know about, when they waited too long because they said, we have an uncle is a general and he's going to get them back again, they didn't come back.
It's so interesting hearing all these stories that I don't like to interrupt you, but no. Didn't you feel that, or were you conscious that you were putting your family at risk, that you were yourself at risk?
I didn't think my family would be at risk, and that was another thing that was pretty shocking for me. I realized after a time that what I was doing, because I talked to the military all the time. I spoke to Videla twice about this. And I spoke to Agin Degi persistently and continually with lists. I took lists of, because they complained, they didn't like the stories appearing in the paper. I said, "I'm not interested. I'm really interested in either these people being put on trial or released. And so if these people appear, there won't be a word in the newspaper about it at all." But of course they didn't, and so one did what I could. I didn't think they would. I honestly came to Argentina and realized that the Argentine military were very respected when I arrived. And they were pioneers in many parts of the country. And military honor, my father was in the, before he became a Marconi man, he was in the British Army, and he loved my wife, as it happens, has relatives who are military people. And so I thought that my family would be okay. I didn't think anything would happen to them. And I honestly, and this is true, but it's perfectly true. I decided that, yes, I was probably going to be killed. I would get up in the morning and say, this is the day when they're probably going to kill me. Well, it never happened, but it enables you to get through the day, because when you've got through the day and you've operated like that. So, and when they did take me away, which was also very useful for a journalist, when they came, I knew they were going to come one day, and I was never, and we'd always been writing in the newspaper, look, if you're going to arrest people you believe are suspects, come in uniform, say where you're taking them, then put them on trial. And we were writing that in the newspaper. So one day, I heard the noise, and I looked through the window where I was preparing a newspaper supplement about Dutch Netherlands independence, the Dutch Day, the independence of Netherland and stories about Holland. And I looked through the window and I saw these characters. Well, they hadn't come in a Ford Falcon. They came in a Renault with the sunroof open, and this guy was sitting there with belts of bullets across his chest, which I really thought was unnecessary for me. And a machine gun sitting on top of the car. So up they came in their leather jackets and so on, completely typecast. So I said, I've got to finish something of this. I can't go with you immediately, having seen films and knowing how you should behave in these occasions. So I said, would you leave with the secretary, the details of where you're taking me? Because they didn't. So I went off with them, and they shoved me in the car, and then they continued. They then talked about how they'd shot up, they'd killed this person that morning, and they'd done this, and the bullets went right through. They were trying to frighten me. And I watched where we were going, and I realized that we were going to what was then called Superintendencia de Seguridad, SS, very, very noticeable. And I'd been on this trip before, because before the coup, they came for Andrew Graham Yule. Again, a rather funny story, but I insisted on going with him, so I had taken that trip before. So I thought, well, at least I'm going to a recognized jail, a legal jail. When I got in there, they pushed me in there and made me strip, and I looked, and ahead of me on this huge wall was huge swastika, and underneath Nazi nationalism, which was very nice of them to tell me exactly what they were like, provided I was going to get out of it. And I did, because by that time I was well known enough for me to be an embarrassment to them. And while I was inside, I was able to hear the screams of people being tortured, something that I thought I'd heard before. And so I got into the beast, and I saw what it was like inside, you know, and that was useful as a journalist. Now, I wasn't able to write. It's another thing I couldn't write about. I felt rather bad, because when I finally, I got out very quickly. They got me out of that prison so fast you can't imagine. I went through four different cells and two prisons in a very short space of time. And they brought the poor judge in, although he was out in his estancia at the weekend. He must have been very disgruntled. So they put me on trial there very quickly and then put me out on bail very quickly. I met with friends afterwards, and I told them about the swastika. I said, I think I should write about this. And they, no, you better not, no, no, Sabrina, oh, you can't do that. So I decided to go, and I asked for an interview with President Videla. He wouldn't give it to me, and I spoke to Captain Carpintero, who handled the press for the military at that time. Naval captain, very pleasant person to deal with, and I said to him, I said, you should tell the president that he should take a bucket of whitewash and take it down to that jail and whitewash out that swastika. And he kind of laughed and said, well, he's not going to do that. No va ser, so no. So that was very illuminating. Now, the terrible thing at the end of it all is that I discovered that these military people did not have any honor. Because the thing that made us leave was a letter, very cruel, sadistic letter, full of lots of details about our family, which had been distorted to make us sound like terrible people, to make my wonderful father-in-law sound, they called him a usurer, you know, usurero, horrible things. And also, very noticeably, that the only people who were mentioned by name as friends of ours were all happened to be Jewish names. And, you know, a threat. And it was written, they were doing this. They had this black propaganda. They would send me letters that looked as if they were from the Montaneros, but they weren't. They were on. And this letter was on. It was addressed to my son of 11 years old. And we were trying to stop him from realizing what was going on. We'd been through a lot because, you know, we had threats from both sides on the other side. The children did too. They went to, an English language school, San Andres, St. Andrew's School, St. Andrew Scott School. And so I wasn't there, but I made a point of coming back around when the children were coming back from school, to be there when they were back from school, and then go back to the office, to the newspaper. And at that time, the letter had arrived, certified mail, handwritten letter, with the envelope was of San Andres, St. Andrew's Scott School. And my wife thought, well, it's probably one of his friends writing to him. They're using, boys do this kind of thing. And so she didn't open the letter. She gave it to him. He opened it. My eldest son looked over his shoulder and said, Montaneros! And poor Peter, and it's only the last year that he's been able to tell us exactly what he felt at that moment. He said, well, I saw the films and I realized that I thought that when you opened a letter like that, the bomb goes off. And he said, get a helicopter, get me out of here. With that, I went to see Argindegi. I said, I know perfectly well who sent this letter. You must know it too. It's very easy to check it out. It's a certified letter, of all things. They were writing these things in CIDE, or military intelligence. I think it was actually CIDE. And he laughed. He said, death threats. He said, my children have got albums full of them. They just laugh about it. So with that, and then the next thing that happened was that, believe it or not, that was a little bit beforehand, they tried to kidnap my wife. They tried to take her. We lived on Avenida Alvear at that time, Montevideo and Alvear, one-way street. she was crossing, because the almacén, Fito's, the little almacén there where we used to pay on, he kept how much we owed him on a nail, on a note on a nail on the wall. It was a wonderful man. And she was crossing the road, and quite suddenly, one Ford Falcon came one way and one the other on a one-way street, so they got cut off the street for that moment. And with enormous presence of mind, or just brilliance, she said, "Oh, disculpe, disculpe." And they hesitated. They took out their guns, and at that time they used to click the automatic so that they were clicking on their guns. It was a horrible sound to hear. And then they got sort of confused, and they let her go. My wife said there was a couple watching, and they said, "Oh, quién está tratando de chupar?" This terrible term that they had, chupar, suck people up like a vacuum cleaner. And she went to Fito. She stayed there for a while, and then she came back again. She told me about it. I found it hard to believe to begin with. You know, I just didn't think they would do that. But then the letter came, and finally, I'd had to leave the country at one point earlier on. So there are a lot of things, but this is probably the basic thing is, I realized they were quite capable of doing anything to my family, which I didn't think before. And so, you know, I didn't want to leave. But I didn't think that I would do what the Papal Nuncio, Pio Laghi, wanted me to do. He said, "Well, you should send your family abroad and you stay here." Well, I said, "I'm not a priest." And so I thought what I would do is go and see Videla. Well, no, he asked to see me, because by that time the Herald had become a kind of symbol that there was, you know, there was a newspaper that was saying things here, and it hadn't been closed down, and so, you know, and democracy, and they were arguing, the moderates, the so-called moderados. So he asked to see me, and I went to see him. And to my horror, although it wasn't surprising, because at the time when I met him before, I realized that he was not the kind of man that was going to stand up and stop what was happening. He didn't have the guts. I have to use those words. He didn't have the guts to do it. And this time he said to me, he said, well, he would like to go home. He would like to give everything up. But if he left, a general would come who would just, would be a bloodbath. The country would be just. And so, you know, very reluctantly and very quietly we left. The news got out. I didn't want people to know really that I was leaving, because I thought that we'd better get back again. But of course we were not able to. So as you can imagine, to be able to come back now and to be, you know, forget the illustrious part, Ciudadano Illustre, but it's just wonderful to be back as a citizen in Buenos Aires with all the problems that exist in Argentina, which is always, you know, I've been through so many of them. I've been absent for 30 years, and it's just glorious to be back again. And it's impossible for me to be anything but optimistic. I see Buenos Aires through rose-tinted spectacles. But I can't do anything. I also see the problems, but the enjoyment of being back when the jacarandas are out in Buenos Aires and the flowers are out and the kiosks full of newspapers and magazines and the flowers and, all the things that people here have kind of got so used to that they don't realize.
They take them for granted.
All for granted. Yeah. And I don't, you know, I don't at all. They're, every day they're a joy. You know, I go out and they're cleaning the pavements. It's an absolute joy, you know. You smell the bread. It's marvelous. It's just glorious for me.
I'm sorry to take you back to the 70s, but there's something I'd like to ask you. Regarding the interview you gave to your son, David Cox, in 2000, you state, regarding life in Proceso Argentina, "Sometimes I asked myself if I was the madman while the rest was sane." Can you enlarge that perception you shared with few?
You see, because so many people refused to recognize what was going on. And I think people were bound to know. I don't see how they couldn't. Because the Ford Falcons went through the streets with these toughs inside. And if you got in their way, you know, they'd bang you, hit you with their guns. And everybody at one time or other knew of somebody who'd been taken away. I mean, in some instances, I mean, there was complete lawlessness. When, you know, now people are talking about lack of security, and there's no doubt about that, it's terrible. But at that time, I had a friend who was just kidnapped for his car by, you know, the security forces. I don't know whether they were police, army, navy, or air force, but that's what they were. He was lucky they didn't kill him. But they made him drive out to behind the Facultad de Derecho, which was one of the places that they used, and told him to get out of the car and run. And he ran and ran and ran. He didn't know whether he would end up riddled with bullets, but he never got his car back. There were lots of incidents like that, so it's very hard to tell. I think you could possibly say that many people managed to live outside it. We know that in other countries in the world. It is possible to live in a kind of mental exile.
Well, the usual statement, there must be some reason.
Exactly. Por algo será. Yes. And so you can...
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you know.
I was at the School of Law at that time. Mm, there must be some reason.
Exactly.
And everything was excusable under that statement.
Of course it was, yes. Because, you know, even if this was a person that she knew perfectly well, it would enable you to think that, well, if it was, you know, that person was a terrorist, you know, I never knew, but, well... But, you know, it was necessary to go beyond that and say, well, even if that person was a terrorist, shouldn't that person be put on trial? Should that person disappear? And those were the questions that were not asked. And that's what made you wonder whether you're not crazy. Another person I worked very closely with was James Nielsen. James Nielsen, I'd say I am apolitical. I really honestly can't tell you whether I've been accused of being a communist, of an imperialist, of a conservative, a liberal, everything under the sun. I don't think I fit any of those. I might be any of those things at one time or another. But James Nielsen was a very, very convinced, traditional conservative, what you would call in Argentina a liberal. These labels are difficult. And I can remember one time saying to him, Jim, you know, but aren't we wrong? I mean, everybody seems to think that this is the way you deal with terrorism, isn't it? And thank God he said, no, the horrible things that they're doing are just not acceptable. And, you know, we were very lonely and because we became very unpopular with friends. I mean, they would cross the road when they saw us coming. And, you know, it was difficult. But my wife was, you know, obviously was the tremendous support because she was somebody who, to begin with, was, she would say, not true, of course, she called herself a typical Argentine housewife, but she wasn't a typical Argentine housewife. There is no such thing as a typical. Argentine women are wonderful. I mean, and this is one of the things that gave me enormous... I say this consistently because it's so true. If the mothers of Plácido Domingo, if the women had not reacted, this could have gone on a lot longer and a lot more people killed. And these were marvelous women who just said, I want to know where my children are. And they were so brave and courageous.
How did you become interested in the movement?
Well, you know, you hear things, and I worked at that time for, well, almost everybody. One time I worked for the New York Times and the Washington Post together, and I got a front page story in the Washington Post with a byline on it, so then I couldn't work for the New York Times anymore. But I worked for The Economist, which was very interesting too, because you don't have your name on it, and so I could write a lot of things for that. As a result of that, I used to go to a building that was called the Safico Building. I saw the other day, it's now called the Transradio Building. Mm-hmm. And this is the building where all the agencies, all the news agencies are. So I would go in there to do my work for Newsweek, which was one of the things, The Economist, and I worked for the BBC for a while too. And at those places, people who were absolutely desperate, who'd gone everywhere looking for their husband or looking for their wife or looking for their daughter, were going to the correspondent saying, can you help? You know, we've been everywhere. What's going on? You know, can you help us? So I met a wonderful woman whose husband was had been taken away. And fortunately, her children had not been taken away. And got to know her. And she said, you know, what's happening now is that people are spending the whole night in Plácido Domingo because there is an officer of the gendarmerie who is receiving people. He gives 10 numbers out every morning at 8 o'clock so 10 people can go and ask him. His original job, I discovered, was to tell people when... before the dictatorship, when people were moved from prison to prison to tell them, you know, your relative has been moved from Trelew to whatever prison it was. That was his job. But people were so desperate, it seemed to be the only place that they might find something. And so When I went, there were probably, I went about midnight, and there were probably then about 10 people, and the crowd gathered during the night. And they'd started to organize then, because it didn't make any sense for thousands of people, anyway, the police would have probably come and got them. So what they arranged was, okay, tomorrow the 10 numbers will go to you, and you. You know, they were organizing. So I started to hear the stories. I didn't identify myself as a journalist, just with them. I just listened to them. So that's how the mothers started to organize and started to get moving. And we became very, very close to them. One, the office was beautifully situated, Azopardo. The office is in Azopardo, just walking distance of Plaza de Mayo and the War Ministry. It's a perfect newspaper to cover revolutions and things like that. And we always had somebody to watch the mothers, so much so that one of our reporters was taken away when they took away the mothers in buses. That was an extraordinary incident, too, because people refused to admit that they were there. At one time, they called them Las Locas, the mad women of Plaza de Mayo, which, of course, made them even more compelling in what story they were telling and about their own suffering. And so we always kept close, and the Herald became a place where people would come, tell their stories, and we would take them all down and we'd discuss and cover what stories we could in regard to them. It seems silly to use the word stories, but that's what we did. And at the same time, and this is not often recognized, and it should be recognized, that Tex Harris, who was sent down by the Carter administration, with the Carter's administration commitment to human rights, he came down here working for Patricia Derrien, and he went to Plaza de Mayo and handed out his card to all the mothers. And also, he kept probably the best list of disappeared people in the U.S. Embassy. He had to leave because of threats against him and also because of a bit of a change of policy in the United States. But his commitment and the commitment of Pat Derrien, who came down here several times, received death threats while she was here. She was the Secretary for Human Rights of the Carter administration. But, you know, all in all, the important thing was to get the information. And that was the hardest thing. The hardest thing in the world was to describe what the word desaparecido meant. At that time, people could not grasp. They couldn't believe it. I had a discussion by cable. At that time, it was also difficult. Communications were difficult. You sent it out by teletype. And the foreign editor of The Economist said, but people do not disappear, you know. Well, they are.
In Argentina, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was hard to get across. And for some of our readers, you know, conservative readers, it was very hard to accept. And, you know, they would say there are lies. It's a lying newspaper. It's a communist newspaper. Cox is a communist, and so those things were difficult.
Okay, that was Robert Cox talking to Rai back in 2009. That was December 2009, and it's one of the best interviews that I ever conducted because Cox is such a reference for many journalists and also a pretty important historic character. Because historical character, because he was a key protagonist in one of the darkest chapters of Argentine history. And he came to our studio back then and talked to us, to me and to Miriam Turcula, my former co-host who retired a couple of years back. We've got time for sharing with you guys a feature on the African roots of tango.
Que justo en la raya afloja al llegar y que al regresar parece decir no olvides hermano, vos sabes no hay que jugar por una cabeza me tejón de un día de aquella coqueta y risueña mujer.
Most of us are familiar with the beautiful and elegant and passionate dance called the Argentine Tango. We've seen it performed countless times on TV shows such as So You Think You Can Dance and Dancing with the Stars, as well as any number of major motion pictures. Most of you probably know that the dance comes from the South American country of Argentina. There are probably some amongst you who already know that it began around the outskirts of Argentina's capital city, Buenos Aires, sometime in the late 1800s. Those of you who have studied a bit of dance history also probably recognize that the original tango evolved from dances that were not only danced locally, but were brought to Argentina from Europe by its growing immigrant population. But how many of you know that the major original influences on Argentine tango are actually African? If you do not know this, you aren't alone. Think about it for a moment. Of all the images you can recollect from every TV show, motion picture, video clip, or photograph you've ever seen featuring the tango, how many times have you actually seen it danced by a black dancer? Now, I don't say this to suggest that it's a bad thing. Far from it. This is how dances evolve. A dance may begin in one community, but as it grows in popularity, it will take on elements of other communities. We've seen this historically in the United States with dances like the Cakewalk, the Charleston, and the Lindy Hop. And we're seeing it even today with the evolution of hip-hop. Our goal here is to simply point out some history that many of you may not be aware of. And so begins my brief history of the black roots of Argentine tango. The Atlantic slave trade, also known as the transatlantic slave trade, refers to the trade in slaves that took place across the Atlantic Ocean from the 16th through the 19th centuries. The vast majority of slaves involved in the Atlantic trade were African from the central and western parts of the continent, who were sold by African slave dealers to European traders who transported them to the colonies in North and South America. There, the slaves were made to labor on coffee, coca, and cotton plantations, in gold and silver mines, in rice fields, the construction industry, timber, and shipping, or in houses to work as servants. More than two-thirds of the slaves who ended up in South America came from the eastern and equatorial region of Africa called Bantu, and a great many of these slaves ended up in the Rio Plata regions of Uruguay and Argentina. There is a single word that has survived through time that fuses all the drum-based black dance and music from that area and era. It is Condombe. These Bantu slaves called their drums tango, and also used this term for the name of the place that they performed the condombe. The dances themselves were also called tangos. During the first half of the 19th century, condombe was a dance typically performed to a group of drummers in large outdoor gatherings of African Argentines who lived mostly in the impoverished barrios in the southern part of the city of Buenos Aires at that time. Candombe represented a fusion of musical and dance traditions from the various parts of Africa from which blacks were brought to that region as slaves. Dancers danced separately with no or occasional minimal contact. It is theorized that the dance we now call tango was born in African Argentine dance venues attended by compadritos, young men mostly native born and poor, who liked to dress in slouch hats, loosely tied neckerchiefs, and high heel boots with knives tucked into their belts. The compadritos took the tango back to the working class districts of Buenos Aires and introduced it in various low-life establishments where dancing took place. Bars, dance halls, and brothels. It was here that the African rhythms met the Argentine milonga music, a fast-paced polka, and soon new steps began to evolve. Eventually, all of Buenos Aires found out about the tango, and by the beginning of the 20th century, the tango, as both a dance and form of popular music, had established a firm foothold in the fast-expanding city of its birth. It is important to note that the tango danced in Buenos Aires at the beginning of the 20th century is not the tango we see today, not even close. Keñique is the term often used to describe the first dance recognized as tango. Keñique first appeared in the slums and at the outskirts of Buenos Aires around the turn of the 20th century and is considered to have lost its popularity by the late 1930s when tango de salón primarily replaced it as the predominant manner of social tango dancing. There are no historical recordings of Keñique dancing, and there has been no one who danced this style in the 1930s who has been able to demonstrate it since the tango renaissance of the mid-1980s. Thus, all that exists to allow reconstruction of the characteristics of Keñique are oral history, some photographs, and vague recollections from childhood of how some adult members of the family danced tango. Nevertheless, despite this, there is a considerable degree of agreement among those attempting to revive this historical tango style as to what characteristics define Keñique. From the 1930s to the present, the Keñique style of tango virtually disappeared, and tango evolved into a dance walked with a straight posture and little vertical movement. This was the predominant stylistic variation of the Golden Age tango de salon, which mostly is due to the influence of the French and other Europeans after the dance was brought from Argentina to Paris in the early 1900s. However, some movements of candombe transmitted through Keñique survived in the milonga of some dancers. The stumble step characteristic of milonga danced to both primary and secondary accented beats, i.e. milonga contrapice, retained some of the rhythmic play inherited from the culture of African Argentines. There also appeared in some milonga music composed and performed during this period a more emphatic variation in rhythmic characteristics of the drums. The music and movements of African Argentine candombe have been represented in tango, particularly in cañinque, or more specifically, mostly currently, in the dance and music of milonga. Nevertheless, there is an evident African Argentine influence upon the evolution of the tango dance and music. Tango is a style of music which resulted from the mixture of several types of music, the habanera, the Spanish fandango, and the milonga. The name tango derives from the word tango, a Bantu term which means drum, and according to the white ethnocentric interpretation, it probably means a meeting or dance of black people. Tango reached its pinnacle of popularity in the 1940s, also known as the Golden Age of Tango, during which it evolved into the form we know today. Now it is considered an integral part of Argentine culture, both in its salon, social, and exhibition theatrical forms. The theatrical form is what you normally see on TV and in movies, while the social or salon form is what is actually danced by most people. Internationally, it is equally popular amongst Hispanic and crossover audiences, with a very large following in many parts of the United States, Europe, Japan, Mexico, and Latin America. And yes, more black people are starting to dance it.
And with that, we come to the end of today's edition of Rye in English. This was the show for Monday, September 15, 2025. My name is Fernando Farias. Thank you very much for listening. You can send emails with QSL cards with reception reports to qslrai@gmail.com or by letter to Maipú Street 555 and then, of course, Buenos Aires, Argentina. This show airs on the shortwaves of WRMI, frequency 5850 kHz, and also via internet on rai.com.ar or our app for mobile devices, Digital Rai, available for both Android and Apple phones. Thank you very much for listening, folks. Have a nice day. Join us tomorrow for a new show of Rye in English. Ciao.